So I'm here to launch or relaunch the reprint of this book. I'm afraid it is old porridge, but it's been put into a new bowl. And it's a very beautiful bowl with a very attractive cover. I should sell it by the cover since the contents are already known to you, perhaps. There's a very interesting picture of Bante. I think it possibly is at the founding of the Western Buddhist Order here in London, looking young and reflective. And on the back, there's a very bright, alert 82-year-old Bante looking out from the cover of the book. There he is, in a very direct and lively way. It's this distinctive quality that he's got. It's funny that I've seen Bante again and again, of course, over many, many years. I first met him in 1969, and I've worked very, very closely with him at times and always been in regular contact with him. But I always find when I go to see him, I get a surprise. He's more than I remember. And you get something of that from the back cover here, that this is a man who's more complex, more subtle, more deep than you can possibly sort of hold in your mind, than I can hold in my mind. So I'm taking this book around and relaunching it. The contents are the same as I launched 14 years ago, but it's been repackaged. And it's not so well known now, so it's due for a bit of a relaunch. I'm doing it at Sangharakshita's own suggestion. I'm here because he asked me to be here to launch this book. He asked me to write it, and he, I won't say oversaw its writing, but he went through it, he approved what I'd done, he made one or two suggestions, and just a few days ago, I think it was last year, I asked him if there was anything that he wanted me to modify or add, and he went through it. And he complimented me greatly on it, and then we discovered he was talking about a different book. but when we got it straight, which book we were talking about, he said no. There was he thought this represented his thoughts quite adequately. So it is an attempt to give an overview of Sangharakshita's own thinking. That's what he asked me to do. He asked me to present his teaching, his approach to the Dharma, his presentation of the Dharma in one go, taking all the different aspects of it and making something of an intelligible whole of it. It's been necessary to do that because his own teaching is so huge. I'm probably one of those who knows his teaching best, and especially in the writing of this and in other enterprises I've engaged in, I've read most of what he's written. I've heard most of what he's said. I've been through all the transcripts of the seminars and so on. But I haven't read everything. I haven't looked at everything. And as I say, I'm probably one of those who's most knowledgeable about Sangharakshita. So it was really been necessary to present an overview. And according to him, it's still valid. And I must say, reading it again myself, I think it's probably, it'll do, it'll stand. I was actually quite impressed. It's strange reading something that you wrote a long time ago because it no longer seems like yours. And you can be profoundly disappointed, of course, when you read that like that. But I'm either ashamed to say or I wasn't. I was quite proud of it. There we are. So I'm going to be discussing not the content of this book, but in a way, why the book is important. Why is it significant for those of you who are here, who are presumably engaged with the Western Buddhist Order and the Friends of the Western Buddhist Order, wanting perhaps to take your involvement deeper in one way or another? Why is this book important? Well, of course, it's important because Sangharakshita is so important to us. He is the founder of the Order, and the teaching which we practice and which we communicate to others is founded upon, is based upon his. He's recently clarified his own understanding of what the order is. In fact, he's published something quite recently, which if you want to look at it, you can find it on his website. He's published what he's called his Last Will and Testament, saying what he thinks the order is, what he thinks we are, if you like, as an order, as a movement. What he said is that he considers that the order, and thereby the movement, is the community of his disciples and of the disciples of his disciples, etc. And these disciples are practicing his particular presentation of the Dharma, and they are, by and large, focusing themselves upon that particular presentation of the Dharma. That's what he wants us to be. That's what he understands that we are. So this book sets out his particular presentation of the Dharma in outline, as well as in some detail. And therefore, it's a good basis for understanding what our teacher teaches. In the end, you have to read him, because it's not just the teachings that he communicates, it's the way he communicates. He's a writer and very much cares about the written word and the way in which writing is done. So it's important to read his work with an ear for the tone that he catches and the way in which he uses language and so on, as it is to take the very ideas that is communicating. So, yes, this can only be an introduction, an overview, which lets you know what the presentation of the Dharma is that we base ourselves upon. So I've mentioned three key ideas, and it's these that I want to explore tonight. I've mentioned the idea of discipleship. The order is the community of disciples and disciples of disciples of Sangharakshita. So what is a disciple? I want to explore that. I've said that the order bases itself upon, it practices and teaches from his particular presentation of the Dharma. So what does it mean to have a particular presentation of the Dharma? Isn't Dharma just Dharma? What is a particular presentation of the Dharma? Why do you need a particular presentation of the Dharma? And then I've talked about what really amounts to the need for commitment to discipleship and the practicing of a particular presentation of the Dharma. So I want to talk about why that commitment is necessary, in my view at least, and in Sangharakshita's view too. So let me take each of these three key ideas in turn. And let me start with discipleship. Probably I'm one of those who's had the most continuous and regular contact with Sangharakshita of all his disciples. I came in contact with him in 1969 in London here. And even in those early days, he went out of his way to connect with me. And I was a bit shy and a bit nervous of him, a bit overawed by him, to be frank. But he wasn't overawed by me. And he sort of went out of his way to connect with me, for which I was extremely grateful. And I remember at one point he was asking me to drive him around London. He later intimated to me that he thought I was a terrible driver. But he allowed himself to be driven around by me, presumably because he wanted the contact with me. I remember we were going somewhere, I was driving him somewhere, and we stopped outside the place that we were going to, and I think for about three quarters of an hour I just fired questions at him, you know, in the front seat of the car, outside wherever it was he was supposed to be. I remember I was asking him about you know, the Nidana chain, and you know, every time he'd reach his hand for the door of the car, I'd ask another question. And I could tell that he was really happy to be passing on his experience of the Dharma to somebody who wanted to know. So, yes, I've got those very early memories of Sangharakshita, and well, I just saw him a couple of weeks ago, I'll see him next week. And although my relationship to him has not always been smooth, how can it be when it comes down to it, he's been a consistent presence in my life and the major force in my life, there's absolutely no doubt. Through my connection with him, whatever of the Dharma that I have practiced and realized has come about. So I'm probably one of his archetypal disciples, if you like. I'm probably one of those who most people would identify as a sort of disciple's disciple, if you like. But nonetheless, we all, in the order, stand directly or indirectly in that relationship of discipleship to Sangharakshita. So I want to sort of explore it a little bit more, again, really from the point of view of my own experience. Something sort of happened to me quite recently that brought home to me what it was to be a disciple. One of the reasons why I've not been around the LBC is I've been spending more time on retreat. And last year I spent 8 months completely secluded. I didn't get in a car for 8 months. I realise it's probably the longest I hadn't been in a car since I was born, when you think about it, or been in any kind of vehicular transportation, in a pram, you know, when I was early. But I spent this 8 months in complete seclusion. I wasn't totally alone for the first 2 months, but from then onwards I was completely alone for much of the time. For a long chunk of time, 5 months about. This is something we're recommended in the order. It's suggested to us, and not just in the order, it's suggested to us that we should spend, Bhante used to say, a month on retreat every year. Few of us achieve that for quite practical reasons, but we're recommended to spend a month completely alone every year, apart from doing everything else as well. And the reason for this is that when you're on your own, you get a much more intense experience of yourself and of your own motivation. The common experience that you will have is of a great sense of relief when the retreat starts. And then after a few days, you'll probably find you can't remember what you're doing there. Dhamma? Meditation? What are they? You just can't quite see the point. This is my experience, and I know quite a lot of other people have said this. I have a friend who's a Kagyu Lama who directs three-year retreats, and he said there's a standard sort of unfoldment of those retreats. The first 2 months, everybody's absolutely ecstatic and really into the Dhamma, but then everybody, maybe not all exactly at the same time, just hits a sort of period when they just can't understand what they're doing there. They have no idea what they've come for, until you have to go down deeper and find something much more basic that's coming from within you. Because we're motivated so much by our relations with other people, and frankly, in many of our cases, by a desire to please, to be seen in a certain way, to live up to certain images of ourselves. I hope I'm not the only one. What I mean is I hope I am the only one, but I'm pretty sure I'm not. We're sort of quite strongly motivated by, desire to be seen well, to appear well, and to be liked, to be accepted, and so on. And when you're on your own, nothing of that is there. Of course, other people are there at the end of the retreat. But the thing about 8 months is that they're an awfully long way away. It's a long, long way before you meet anybody. So you really don't have to sort of think about that. You can't think about it. Actually, it's interesting, just by the way, what I found was that I was more strongly and more directly connected with other people than I'd have thought. You don't have to believe me, but I picked up quite a lot of what was going on out there and quite a lot of what people were thinking about me. Some of it wasn't very pleasant, and one or two people confessed to me later that they'd been thinking of me in a particular way. And I knew. So it's odd, when you get that length of time just on your own, your mind becomes very clear in a certain sort of way, and you pick up what's going on around you. But be that as it may, the main thing is that you don't have an opportunity for interaction through which you can recreate yourself. That's what we're doing a lot of the time, isn't it? We're recreating ourselves, creating an image of ourselves through talking, through dressing, through acting. We try to make a picture of ourselves that, you know, we think feel good about, and that other people will admire or respect or love or just accept. The retreat is very, very good for finding out what your basic motivation is, and for getting to a deeper level of motivation. A long retreat is even better, because you're even more on your own. So what I found, I sort of expected that I'd get on the retreat, I'd start meditating, you know, first dhyana, second dhyana, third dhyana, fourth dhyana, stream entry, etc. It wasn't quite like that, I'm afraid. I have to admit, it wasn't quite like that. Because what you're left with when there's nothing outside you to sort of gauge you or to form you, is just you. So you have, or I had, and I imagine others would have, a very, very vivid experience of your mind. And most of what it is boring. It's really, really boring. I've said again and again that one of the experiences I had that really shook me was sitting in a meditation and very carefully reconstructing a James Bond movie that I'd seen 30 years before. And what's more, that I hadn't enjoyed 30 years before. But I had to work out who did what and what happened and why this happened and so on and so forth. So everything that's been you've done, everything that's gone into your mind is still there. It's all in the Pali tradition is called the Bhavanga Sutta, the stream of constant undercurrent, this undercurrent of psychic energy that draws in all your experience and then sort of feeds it back to you under the conditions of karma, according to circumstances and situations. Up it comes. Apparently quite at random, but actually in accordance with, you know, causes and conditions that you often can't see. And maybe just the sort of a queuing system, as it were. They've been sort of backed up in the stream, and it's just time for them to pop up when there's nothing else to happen. And blow me down, there they are. And the most boring, most trivial and most humiliating things. I found myself experiencing a lot of shame. Things that I'd done way back in my life. Often, I haven't done anything terribly bad, but I've done the normal load of insensitivity, petty cruelty, unkindness, failure to really see other people as people. I've done all that, and it's all left its trace in my mind. And in those circumstances where the space is so vast, up it all comes. Bit by bit, and you have to just sort of face it. I wrote a series of poems about solitude, and one of them, I can't remember the lines, so I won't inflict my very minor poetry upon you, but it was something to do with solitude is a cupboard, the door of which is open in solitude, and out come all the skeletons, bone by bone. And you just have to sit there while they dance themselves to dust. That's what solitude is of that kind. You just have to face what's there and watch it come out. So you're experiencing what I experience, the force of karma. This current of energy that is my mind, it's me really, that I've been creating for 60 years in my case, just flowing along, and sometimes it's a lot of the time to begin with very painful, just what it's like, then quite humiliating, and then after about 2 months really funny. It's just really funny. You know, I'd start to sort of notice the same patterns recurring. And, you know, you sort of say, ah, there you are again. That's, you know, pattern number 7 recurring for the 576th time. And it becomes sort of funny. I remember I got some inspiration from remembering something that Shinran said. It's easy to misunderstand it, but he talks about being I can't remember the Japanese and I can't remember the exact translation, but something along the lines, bomsu is it, being an ordinary stupid person. And for him, recognition that you're an ordinary stupid person is stream entry. You just realise that you're just an ordinary person with these patterns formed by your karma just constantly reproducing themselves in your mind. It becomes sort of funny. But I must say, at times it became really quite deeply humiliating and more than anything just boring, this constant repetition. Of course, I was putting positive energy in. I was doing my practices and they did have an increasing effect on this flow of the mind. But in a sense, even that doesn't really quite reach it. But what I did notice that it did reach it was visualization practice that I was doing. I was imagining the Bodhisattva Manjushri, my own Yidam, chosen deity, as they call it. And I felt that sort of lift me above this circle, this vicious circle that's me. And I was also doing prostration practice, where you imagine the Buddha as seated on a lotus tree with representations of the Dharma and the Sangha, and of many teachers, including your own teacher. So in front of me was Sangharakshita. And you bow down, you prostrate before that figure. And what I found was that this sort of lifted me out onto another level. It lifted me up out of the vicious circle onto another level of experience altogether. It was as if by connecting with imaginatively these minds beyond my own, minds that were far deeper, far broader, far clearer than mine, my own became clearer. Or it wasn't even as if it was my own. It didn't feel as if it was my own. It felt as if I was in another mind altogether. Not that it was their mind that I was in, but it was a mind beyond mine in the ordinary sense. What sort of cemented this experience for me was reading through Sangharakshita's memoirs. There's five volumes of his memoirs, which start from his own birth and come right through to his founding of the FWBO. And there are other things that I read that go further on than that. And, throughout the time I've known him, Sangharakshita has been plodding away at producing these memoirs, and I, like a number of others, have questioned whether this was the best use of his time. Wouldn't it be better if he was on retreat with us or whatever? I've wondered whether memoirs were the best possible medium for him. When he knows what he's doing, he's pretty determined to just carry on. So it was water off a duck's back, our comments about this. But when I read through them in this context, I realised what he'd been doing. In those memoirs, he's communicated himself in a much more vivid and full way than he's able to do in any of the more didactic works, or even in his poetry, I think. Although the poetry brings out maybe something else as well. But he's communicated himself. There's a lot of direct teaching there, actually, if you take it if you're looking for it. But more than anything, there's a sort of mood and atmosphere which is to do with his way of looking at things, his approach to the world, and the way in which he looks at himself, the way he works with himself, the way he works with the Dharma. And I found I was extremely happy while I was reading these memoirs. To begin with, I thought it was, you know, just my practice bearing fruit. But after a while, I realised it was conditioned by my contact with Sangharakshita through reading his memoirs. And I felt myself lifted up into, again, a completely different state of mind over a continuous period of time. And I never really went back to it, to so much to the old patterns. And in a way, I haven't done since. They're still there, but I seem to be able to sort of keep something above that. So what I'm describing is what I mean by discipleship. It's opening yourself up to a mind that is greater than your own. I'm not trying to claim anything about what that mind is. I know Sangharakshita is not the Buddha. The Buddha is beyond Sangharakshita, that's for sure. He's made that clear in his own indirect way, as it were. There's greater depths, greater heights beyond him. But in my personal experience, he's the great. His is the greatest mind that I've encountered. It's not perfect. He's a funny old thing in some ways. He's a very particular character from a very particular time. I don't have a lot of difficulty with much that he says. Some others of his disciples do. And you're sure to find when you read this, there are bits of what Sangharakshita has to say that grate, rather. But in a way, that doesn't really matter. Again, I don't think I'm quite sort of... Our characters aren't easily conformable, his and mine. In some ways they are. Where Dharma is concerned, where the movement is concerned, they're very much so. But on a more sort of personal level, we're not really each other's type, if you see what I mean. And that used to cause me a lot of pain, but I've come to realise that types are types. You can't change it, he can't change it in a certain sense. So it's not to do with, you know, sort of getting on terribly well and terribly easily. It's to do with a connection between you at a much deeper level, and a sense that you're in contact with something that's of a majesty, that's way beyond what you yourself can realise, and that you open yourself to and allow yourself to be lifted up by. So it's what we call Kalyanamitrata, a contact with someone more experienced than yourself, more experienced not just in terms of life, not having lived longer, but having a deeper experience of the Dharma, having realised the Dharma more fully, more deeply. And allowing yourself to come into a vivid interaction with that person. It may not be possible to do it directly. Many of you will never have that chance. You can probably still meet him. And I hope that you will invite him constantly to the RBC while he's still alive and kicking, very much kicking. But you won't necessarily find it easy. Actually, on the whole, probably when you meet him in a formal interview, if you go to see him, you'll find him absolutely charming, absolutely delightful. He's a very, very sensitive, very warm-hearted man, very, very quick to pick up where people are at, and very easily able to give a lot of attention and some very simple, wise advice, often without you even knowing that simple, wise advice has been given. Yes, you need to come into a sort of more close connection than that. Seeing him helps, but then after that, for most of us, it's a question of reading and meeting him through the order, through the movement. His influence is the deepest and most powerful on the order and movement. Of course, we all influence it, especially those those who are order members. We all influence, but everybody influences this living community that we have. But his is the foundational influence, and so you open yourself up to that, and you come into a vivid interaction with it. But it doesn't mean you're just passive. You don't just, you know, like a chick in a nest, just sit there and wait for the worms to be dropped in, to use a rather violent image. You engage. You engage with the problems. You engage with the areas of dissonance. You engage with the areas where you in the end have to say you disagree. Of course, if those disagreements go deep enough and are serious enough, well, really, you can't be a disciple. You won't be a disciple. You won't want to be a disciple. But on a lot of matters where you might disagree, it's not really that important. But where fundamental issues of the nature of the Dharma are concerned, well, that clearly is vitally important. But you come into that sort of relationship with the man through his work, through his expressed work, and you have to grapple with that, because it's very, very difficult to be in a sort of uneven relationship, isn't it, where there's somebody who you acknowledge to be in some sense further than you or higher than you in some way. It makes it very complicated, because there's often an easy losing of yourself. You start just adopting that other person's thoughts and even mannerisms. It's not necessarily a bad thing. I remember in the early days of the FWBO, when I was of my life in the order, when I was teaching, I would even tell the same jokes as Sangharakshita, and I'd even use the same intonation and so forth, quite unconsciously. But you know, I wasn't very confident, so I was sort of borrowing from him some false confidence. I, you know, feel a bit embarrassed if somebody caught me at the time, but I don't blame myself for having done it back then, because it's part of the process of trying to get at what really he has to contribute to you. So the relationship is not necessarily a simple one. It's almost certainly not a simple one. For my own part, it's been relatively straightforward much of the time, although I've had quite severe hiccups where I haven't quite known, you know, whether I wanted to open myself up to what he had to say and what he was doing. But I think compared with many, it's not been so difficult for me. But yeah, there's an inevitable tension between your sort of desire to assert yourself, to be yourself, and a losing of yourself. Do you see what I mean? You can either over-assert yourself and therefore lose the benefits of opening to something beyond yourself, or you can open yourself so much that you cease to exist in a psychological sense. You just become the other person. I mean, this often happens in ordinary relationships, particularly in sexual or romantic relationships. There's a sort of complicated business of trying to find out where the boundaries lie. And in a way, there's certain aspects of a relationship of a disciple to a teacher that are not dissimilar. You're sort of opening yourself up to the energy, to the spirit of the teacher. And that means you've got to be quite sure of yourself. You've got to be quite clear about yourself. You've got to be quite an individual. And you won't be. To begin with, you won't be. And especially when you're coming in contact with somebody who's very much an individual. From a very early age, Sangharakshita told me quite recently that he knew his own mind. He said that even when he was a child, before he could talk, he realised that his mind was quicker and sharper than that of people around him. And he said he discovered how to manipulate his mother. Actually, all babies do that, but they're usually not conscious of it. So he's that sort of man, very, very self-possessed, very clear about what's important to him. And there's that fascinating part in his biography where he's with a very difficult friend and they're on retreat together. And the friend basically goes a bit mad and starts to assert things about spiritual life and so forth that Sangharakshita doesn't agree with. And this friend was rather muscular and at one point tried to drown him. But he said he realised while this was happening that there was a stubborn streak in him and that he was not prepared to compromise on what he believed, even at risk to his life. And that's very much my experience of him. There's an uncompromising streak in him, which is not stubborn in the egotistical sense. It's a clarity about what really matters to him, which I've never, in the end, found simply egotistical. So, yes, there's a tension, because you are not yet necessarily an individual. You're not necessarily really clear about who you are. And often what happens in a relationship with a teacher, whether somebody is as extraordinary as Sangha Rakshita, or whether it's more just your teacher who teaches you meditation at the centre, you're probably likely to sort of reflect old patterns of particularly with your parents and so on, and teachers from the past. You play it all out again in relation to the teacher. So all of that has to be worked out. So it's not simply, you know, the path of love and surrender, as they say in India. Indians are very, very good at handling this sort of thing. They use the rhetoric often of love and surrender, but they quietly get on and do what they want. In the West, we actually try to do it, poor fools, and often it backfires on us. So it's a real active relationship which is constantly under re-evaluation, constantly requiring a self-examination, and constantly requiring new communication, if that's available to you, and a re-assessment. So being a disciple is not a simple, I found my teacher, now I do what he says. It's a question of a vivid interaction, often at the level of the imagination, which is going to be problematic, is going to be require a critical intelligence, so that you do not simply accept, but you critically examine. And if you do disagree, you think through the disagreements very fully, very deeply, and, you know, work out whether in the end you remain a disciple or not. So it's an active relationship, and not a necessarily an easy one. I think for me, the times when there have been problems in my discipleship, those are the times that I've made most spiritual progress, because interaction with somebody of that kind, where you have to define your own position, it forces you to grow. You can't simply assert yourself and say, no, doing it my way. Your own intelligence and your spiritual sensitivity will not leave you do that. But at the same time, you can't just accept. So you have to grow, essentially. You have to become a bigger person in order to resolve the tension that grows up. And I've experienced this again and again and again in my own relationship with Sangha Rakshita. He's, by and large, an extremely kind and sensitive man. He very seldom gives anybody any very direct direction. He has said once that I was one of the few people he'd done it to. I couldn't work out when. I think he's so subtle that I didn't notice. I hope I actually took the lesson, but I didn't notice it happening. So being a disciple is a very intense practice, but for most of us, I think, an indispensable one. We're just so caught up with this current of our own mind. It's really difficult to get above it, to get beyond it. And what we're very, very good at is recreating a structure that sort of makes us comfortable. It may make us comfortable in an uncomfortable sort of way, because for some of us, discomfort is a form of comfort. But you sort of reconstruct, you reconfigure your inner world so that it all works. Of course, it never really does, because reality isn't like that. But you get something that approximately sort of holds together. The scaffolding all sort of fits together, even if you haven't tightened up the final, what do you call them? Putlocks, no. Anyway, the final things that... What? Anyway, you don't get it all to sort of fit. You can't get it all to fit properly. But you keep on trying. A lot of our effort is to sort of make it all work, so that we can keep up this sort of illusion of things that is us. For most of us, it's really important that we have an interaction with something that is beyond that. Some people are very fortunate, they have an imaginative connection, well, maybe even with the Buddha. I've met people like that, people to whom the Buddha has appeared in a vision or a dream or something like that. But for most of us, it's a person, whether, as I say, directly or indirectly, or a person experienced through other people, an influence experienced through other people. For most of us, that's what we require. In fact, for us, it's the whole order, but that order is informed by the creative mind of Sangharakshita. So we need that, most of us. I would advance, I would suggest. That's my own impression, my own experience. We need that. Otherwise, we're just caught up in this cycle, this vicious cycle of our own defense mechanism, the mechanism to make us happy, to make us okay. The wheel of life goes round and round and round. Spiritual practice does make some inroads on that, but oddly it often just adjusts and smooths off. It's like sandpaper. But you need something much more supervenient, something that just goes beyond, that takes you beyond. And that is what I experienced in a very vivid way on my solitary retreat, but something I've experienced throughout my life in the order. So for us, Sangharakshita is the spiritual teacher who engagement with whom is our principal means of going beyond ourselves, even if that engagement with him is indirectly through his work, through his written work, or through his work in creating a Sangha. So let me move on to the second element of what he's been saying recently, this particular presentation of the Dharma. What we engage with as members of the order all over the world is Sangharakshita's particular presentation of the Dharma. So, well, 2,500 years ago, the Buddha rediscovered, as it's said by Buddhist tradition, rediscovered in this historical era the path to awakening. He awakened himself and revealed the path to awakening. He had many direct disciples, and his disciples had disciples, and to begin with, for many years, many centuries even, there was still a very strong sense of direct discipleship with the Buddha. First of all, he was represented by various symbols like the stupa, later by the Buddha image, and people had a very strong sense that they were with the Buddha, and that they were the Buddha's own direct disciples. You know, when we meditate, we sit in two rows, usually, facing each other. That is a Buddhist tradition used in many parts of the Buddhist world, which reproduces the situation that you find in the Pali Canon, for instance, where somebody comes to the Buddha, greets him, and sits down at one side. So in a slightly, rather formulaic way, we're reproducing being with the Buddha. And it seems as if for quite a long time that was enough for people. They would have their own personal disciple, personal teacher, but they felt very much that they were working within the Buddha's own presentation. But of course, as time went on, times changed, issues changed. The Dharma's own natural unfolding led to various problems, various bifurcations, and so on. So what you begin to find, if you look at Buddhist history, is that again and again, great teachers have arisen who've taken what's come down to them and re-expressed it in a way that's relevant to their own disciples, and created of the teaching that's come down to them a workable whole, which makes sense of the whole thing and makes a practicable path. You see this again and again. You get great figures. Well, in Tibetan Buddhism, of course, there's Padmasambhava, who founded the Nyingma tradition. There's Tsongkhapa, who founded the Gelug tradition. You get in the Far East, you get Shinran, who founded the, or at least who is the second founder, it's sometimes said, of the Pure Land School, and so on, the true Pure Land School, Jodo Shinshu. And so on. You get great figures who take what they've been given, which has in some sense become problematic, doesn't quite work, doesn't quite hang together, doesn't meet the needs of the situation, and they re-express it so that it works for those that they're in contact with, and if they get it right, as it were, works for a great many people for a great many centuries even sometimes. Eventually, often, they run out. Inevitably, everything runs out in this life. So eventually, the particular presentation no longer fits the circumstances. What you'll often get then is a sort of second founder or refounder within that tradition. You know, you get in the Chan tradition, there was Bodhidharma as the semi-mythical founder of the Chan tradition. Then you get Huineng, who really refounded it, you could say, in its northern form, southern form. So this process has been going on throughout the Buddhist tradition. It needs to be re-comprehended because it's too much. There's too much available. It doesn't necessarily all hang together. And I think supremely in these times, we're faced with that. Here in London, there must be, I would guess, I haven't looked at the figures, probably 200 or 300 different Buddhist traditions represented. Often, you know, traditions within traditions, I know, but you'll get 200 or 300 different Buddhist traditions. The whole Buddhist history, so to speak, is present in the modern world. For the first time, most of these traditions didn't even know about each other. The Theravada knew nothing of Zen until the last century or so. Nothing was known by the Tibetans about the Theravada. Sangharakshana told me that when he first encountered Tibetans, he always found a slight reserve. And that it was a reserve because he was wearing a yellow robe. And they'd read about yellow robe monks in their scriptures, which basically said they were followers of a lesser path. So they were a bit nervous that they might get drawn down to a lesser level. There were no real dialogue, no real contact between them. But we've got the lot. Not only have we got the lot, we've got the whole machinery of Western scholarly, critical scholarly examination. We know so much more about the history of Buddhism accurately from evidence than has been known before. Even in the last 40 years, we know far more than we did 40 years ago. For instance, if you read a survey of Buddhism, you'll get an account of the origins of Mahayana, which really, in the light of modern scholarship, are a bit laughable. It's just sort of like a just-so story. It's a much more complex and slow process of evolution. So we know so much more. We've got this scholarly critical machinery. Most of us are capable of using it to a small extent. We've got this huge plethora of teachings. What on earth are we to do? How are we going to make sense of it? How are we going to approach it? I found myself very much in this position in 1969 when I started to be interested in Buddhism. I went looking I just completely bewildered, even in those days when there's relatively little available. What did I do? How did I approach the Dhamma? How did I apply it to my own life? It was a great sigh of relief. I came across somebody who was willing to tell me how to approach this Buddhist tradition. He had an angle on the whole tradition, but at the same time a critical angle on it. He was able to approach it in the light of modern scholarship. He was able to be critical of it from, for instance, a sociological perspective, from a political perspective, even to some extent, from a philosophical perspective, and to form out of what came to us from all aspects of the tradition, to form a meaningful and workable whole. That was what he did. And it's what I, for one, desperately wanted and still need and work with. We need a presentation of the Dharma that we can work with, that we don't just get lost in the overwhelming multiplicity of it, in the contradictions that there are. If you set one tradition against another, often they can be quite literally contradictory. They say quite different things. So we need a perspective that is integral. And this is what Sangharakshita has done for us. That's what his particular presentation of the Dharma is. It's not that it's necessarily the only possible one, or even the only right one, or the only appropriate one. One doesn't need even to get into that debate. There may be other ways of practicing the Dharma that do work. But it is an approach that itself, we consider, does work, and that is sort of integral. It all hangs together. It's not complete, it's not final, it will continue to evolve as time goes on. It must do, because times change. Nothing stands still. And between us, we need to work out how we evolve that in an integral way, so we don't do violence to what is basically there, and we take it forward. But yes, what Sangharakshita has done is make sense of it all in our contemporary situation. And that contemporary situation is not just a Western one in the geographical sense. It's a worldwide one. We had, even here on Sunday, we had some mitra ceremonies of two people from a Chinese Buddhist background who one of them, I read what she'd said, that for her, the Buddhism that she came from didn't really mean very much. It was superstition. And it was, she was a modern woman with an outlook that, to loosely frame it, was modern. The Buddhism that she'd inherited just was superstition that didn't apply to her. But when she came across Sangharakshita's presentation of the Dharma, she saw that it worked for her and actually made sense even of what she'd learnt as a child. I've seen the same quite recently. I think I mentioned on my talk on Sunday that the Ladakhi Mitra that we had in Bodh Gaya in March became a Mitra for the first time under the Bodhi tree. So he comes from a Tibetan cultural background in northern India. And he told me that he felt a lot for his Tibetan Buddhist background. Very, very strong feelings of devotion to the lamas and for the tradition as presented to him. But he couldn't do anything with it. He was studying politics at JNU, which is the sort of top university in Delhi, and it just didn't relate to him. He didn't know how to engage with it, apart from going and becoming a monk in a monastery up in the snows. He didn't know how to put it into practice. And when he came across TBMSG, the FWBO in India, he saw how this tradition that he revered so greatly was relevant in the modern world and how he could practice it. Many of our Indian friends have, of course, come from a quite different sort of background. They come from a very poor, oppressed community. But they're part of a new world. Dr. Ambedkar, their leader, their great leader, many of you know about him, was very much part of that world, was a very much a contemporary man. And Sangharakshita's presentation of the Dharma works for them. As I say, it's not necessarily the only one that works, but it's one that works for us and that we believe will work for many, many others. And we value that presentation of the Dharma very, very highly and want to offer it as widely as we can. So, last point under this heading. Commitment. We need to apply ourselves to that presentation of the Dharma in discipleship with our teacher. If we don't do that, if we don't commit ourselves to a particular presentation of the Dharma, it's extremely difficult to make spiritual progress. I won't say it's impossible. After all, Sangharakshita himself had to do that. He had to make sense of all the traditions that came to him. In a sense, you could say the Buddha had to do that. He studied with some of the leading Hindu gurus, they were Shramaniya as Samana, but the Indian gurus of his time. Those sort of individuals are very, very rare. I'm certainly not one. I can't make sense of it all myself. And I'm very, very pleased, very grateful that somebody's done that condensation for me. Sangharakshita himself said, if he'd found a satisfactory presentation of the Dharma, which he could have applied himself to, he'd have grabbed it with gratitude. He told me once, he didn't want to start a new Buddhist movement. He felt that it wasn't really quite his sort of forte. In some ways, he didn't have the right qualities for it. Perhaps in some ways his character is not the best for it, he said. He would have been very happy, he said, to have been spent his time in a traditional monastery, practicing in a traditional way. But it didn't work. It couldn't work. And it couldn't work for others. So he was forced, so to speak, to create that presentation of the Dharma. And we, at least in the order, are very grateful to him and accept fully what he's given to us. If others don't want to do that, that's fine. If you want to take something from us and take something from somewhere else, that's fine. Up to a certain point, you can't get very far with us doing that, but you can come as far as you want, as you like, rather. It's a bit like trying to get water out of a well. You imagine that you've got a number of wells and you want to get water out of them. You don't get water by putting your bucket halfway down every well. You don't get anything out of it. You have to drop it all the way down one well. You may then find that it's the same water in all the other wells, if you bother to try to find out. But in the end, you need to apply yourself fully to one particular presentation of the Dharma and apply yourself consistently. Spiritual growth comes from intensity of engagement. An intensity comes from a certain simplicity of presentation. If you find it even with the practices that you all do, the mindfulness of breathing and Maitri Bhavana, you need to actually do the Anapanasati, you need to do the mindfulness of breathing. If halfway through you just switch over and do the Metta Bhavana, well, you get something, but you won't get much. You won't get the full possibility of concentration you'd get by applying yourself to it fully. So you need a certain kind of simplification, a certain kind of concentration, and to apply yourself to that fully. Of course, periods come when it stops working, and then you need to do some investigation, reassemble, and go further. But you need to develop a certain degree of intensity of engagement if you're serious about self-transformation. You need to apply yourself fully to one approach. At least the great majority of people need that. I certainly need that. You can't just sort of mix and match. You can't easily take a little bit from here, a little bit from there, because each of them belongs to an integral system. That system all hangs together. So when you take a bit out of one context, it doesn't easily sit in another. But unless you're very, very knowledgeable and very wide awake, it's quite easy to become severely confused just by how all these fit together. And, of course, this is a major problem for us in the modern world because we live in a supermarket. Our modern society is a supermarket society. And even our Buddhist world in the West is a supermarket. You can get anything. You can get tantric initiation, you can get Zen koans, you can get things I'd never even heard of, off the internet. You can shop from here to there, and yeah, you can make your own mix and match approach. But I doubt if many will be able to make anything that really develops the kind of intensities required. Anyway, it's a reflection of modern life generally, isn't it? That it tends to superficiality. Modern life tends to multiplicity of experience and lack of depth of experience. It's very difficult to really absorb and really feel anything because you so quickly move on to something else. And in a way, we're encouraged to do that. There's a whole industry that encourages us to consume more and more. And there's even a Buddhist industry encouraging us to consume more and more. So the supermarket approach, in the end, doesn't really work, at least for the great majority of people. I can't speak for everybody, but certainly in our order, our general approach is that we need to focus. And we need, what Sangha actually says is, we need more and more of less and less, not less and less of more and more, which is the supermarket approach. So you need to take one thing, or a range of things that sort of hang together, and apply yourself to them very deeply, very fully. So what we understand, or what Sangharakshita believes we should understand a disciple is somebody who takes on a system of spiritual training within a particular presentation of the Dharma and applies themselves to it in a committed way over a consistent and long period of time until it begins to take effect and naturally begins to evolve to some new stage. So that is how we understand discipleship. It's this application to a particular presentation of the Dharma and an application with great intensity so that it begins to bite. Now there's an aspect of Sangharakshita's teaching that I want to bring out more fully that I think enfolds this, gives a context for this. He's always stressed that the application of spiritual practice is helped or hindered by context. It's extremely difficult to make progress in adverse circumstances. You can, especially if you're a very, very inspired person, you can make the most difficult of circumstances into favourable ones. But everybody knows from going on retreat, when the circumstances are good, it's much easier to make some progress. So he stressed that it's very important, if you want to be an effective spiritual practitioner, to think about your environment, to think about the context within which you're practicing. You need, in effect, to create for yourself a new life, a new way of life. And in a sense, you could say, being his disciple means doing that as best you can. Means doing something about your own life, doing something about the way you live and the way you work. It means doing something not only about your own life, but about the world. It means addressing the world as a context within which human beings live and realize their own spiritual potential. So there are inner and outer dimensions to this issue, the issue of context. There's an issue of the context for you, and there's the issue of the context for others. So I want to very briefly explore this. There's a great deal more to say about this. We used to talk about it under the heading of New Society, but that seems to ring all the wrong bells these days, or not really interest people. But for those of you who want the reference, that's what I'm really talking about. The idea that we need to transform the world, both for our own sakes and for the sake of others. So, we need an alternative way of life. Let me look at it from the inner side, first of all. Serious spiritual practice requires good conditions, requires the right conditions. If you are to make progress, you need a certain number of basic conditions. So this is what the Buddha says in the Pali Canon. Well, you need a positive human environment. You need friendship. You need people around you who support you, who understand your spiritual efforts, who endorse your spiritual efforts. If you're with people who don't believe in them, it's very, very difficult to hold your head above water. So you need a positive human environment. You need a degree of simplicity in your life. A complex, distracted life makes a complex, distracted mind. It's very, very difficult to concentrate. You know, when you come to meditate, you're trying to concentrate. Most people will find it extremely difficult because of the circumstances under which they live, especially in a great city like London, such a busy and complex city as London. They will find that weighing upon their minds. It'll be very, very difficult to focus. You know, there's a lot of debate about how to meditate and whether this technique works or that technique works. I think technique is relatively unimportant. I think the most important thing is the mind that you bring in to the meditation. And that mind is formed by what you do outside the meditation. And that's it's formed by the world in which you live outside the meditation. So you need to try to live a simple, even beautiful life, a life that's surrounded as much as you can be by upliftment and inspiration. Very striking in a modern situation how little uplift there is. I remember first becoming aware of this, I went into a shopping centre. I couldn't understand why I was feeling so depressed, sort of oppressed and depressed. And sort of looking around. Well, first of all, I didn't really want anything, but I felt I ought to. And secondly, there were no images of anything that was of any kind of higher nature. If there were, by chance, Buddha images in shop windows or something, they were there for commercial reasons, or you know, they'd be on a poster for some you know, underarm deodorant or something like that. So that images are trivialised, and there's very little that's suggestive of some higher human value. In the world of shopping isn't really interested in that. It's only interested in it to try to get us to buy. So in evoking those images, it debases them. And so much of our modern environment is uninspiring, uninspired, without an upward gaze. So you need a context that's simple, beautiful, inspiring. It's very difficult to live a spiritual life without that. Then you need an ethical life. You need to be living an innocent life, not you know, heaping up lots and lots of inner tension because of the petty little acts of cruelty that you perform. I mentioned even my own experience on solitary retreat of realising all these petty acts of cruelty going way back in my life that are just sort of impacted into my mind. And I realised that it's very, very difficult to meditate when those are not resolved. They're there. You can do it to some extent, but they're there in the back of your mind, in the background of your mind. And they hold you back. I don't mean necessarily anything really gross. Of course, if it's gross, it's in some ways easier because you know what it is and you can express it and deal with it. It's the petty acts that hold us back, and most of us are involved in them all the time. Just little acts of irritation and unkindness, insensitivity, and stupidity. They all build up in the mind, and when you meditate, they hold you back. That your mind will not naturally concentrate. Then you just need to be mindful. You just need to be aware, especially of your body. Again, there's so much about modern life that takes you away from direct physical experience, especially more and more with our phone in one ear and a computer in the other. Forget the metaphor. You know, where we're using technology so much of the time, it removes us from our direct bodily experience. It's a very powerful fact. That the technology we use, by and large, we use in an alienating way. And the whole a modern city life tends towards alienation, tends towards removal from a simple, direct experience of the body. And what you find is that you know, you work really hard on your computer all the time, and was it some? You, I think it was one of the new mitras wrote. And then you get soaked for the weekend because you need to get some sort of. You need to have a really strong experience to compensate for the fact that you got really over out of touch with yourself in another way. So we stagger from alienation to excess until we're burned out. To put it rather overdo it. So, yeah, we need to be mindful. We need to be actually just simply aware of ourselves, of our bodies especially. The Buddha says, if you've got all that, it really doesn't matter what meditation practice you do. You just sit down, you're aware of yourself, you're secluded, there's a beautiful, inspiring environment, you're innocent, your mind is quite innocent, there's nothing weighing upon you, you feel in good relations with people around you, you just become concentrated. it's a sort of nidana chain. It's the conditions being there, the states will arise. Jhana arises naturally, independence upon seclusion of the body, mindfulness, and happiness. Happiness is the consequence of a moral life, of a skillful life. So our lives, the circumstances of modern life, make it very difficult to build up these conditions. So if you're serious about spiritual practice, about spiritual life, you need to think about the conditions in which you place yourself, because it'd be very difficult for you to make serious inroads upon your habits of mind, and the deepest habit of mind, the habit of self, without building up those conditions. But it's not just a question of creating those conditions for yourself, it's a question of creating them for others. Partly, you might say, even in self-interest, because if those conditions are not there for others, they will sooner or later impinge upon you. We can't get away anymore. I live halfway up a mountain in Wales, but we're still impinged upon. The RAF visits us quite frequently. The world is very much around us, very much with us. You can't get away anymore. So even from our own point of view, we need to attend to the world around us. But it's much more significant than that. The world is quite a mess, and it's perhaps in the most dangerous condition it's ever been in. In the last 60, 70 years, it's been in an extraordinarily dangerous condition, especially with nuclear weapons. So much danger to the future of humanity from nuclear warfare. Of course, terrorism heightens that, because once nuclear weapons are in the hands of terrorists, someone will use them. This also, of course, eco-disaster. Where I think it's not a very apocalyptic statement, or not a very prophetic statement. I'm not very clever to say that we're in the most dangerous condition we've ever been in. The world is really on the brink. But it's not just that we're aware of the world as never before. We know so much about it, and there's so much suffering in the world. It really struck me coming out of solitary retreat, where, you know, I saw the suffering of the sheep, which is bad enough. There's sheep all around me. They're really sort of tragic. I find it very painful, actually, being in the middle of a sheep farm, you know, because you just see these animals that are just going to be eaten. But, I was insulated from human suffering by and large. But it's as soon as I came out and started to inform myself, I found it flooding in upon me. Enormous amount of suffering that there is. Just simple, direct suffering of hunger, poverty, and so on. And then, you know, the suffering of oppression and injustice that there is everywhere in the world. Even in Britain there is that. But in many, many parts of the world. And there are a lot of parts of the world where people suffer partly because of the history in which those of us in this country are now the beneficiaries. For instance, Britain's wealth was built on slavery, and we're still the beneficiaries of the colonial period. Britain developed on that basis. I don't think it's a question of feeling guilty about it, but it's a question of being aware of where we stand in the world, and of recognising that our benefits are from the sufferings of others, and that some others still suffer because the balance has not been struck. Again, I'm so aware of this working in India. India's an absolutely remarkable country in so many ways, and anything you say about India, you can immediately think of the opposite. But one thing is definitely true: there's a huge amount of suffering in India, and a lot of that suffering is of the very direct kind, which comes from poverty and hunger and hopelessness, no jobs, no outlook. But that comes about because of the system, to some extent. It comes about because the world system the system that has developed over the last centuries. India, before the British came, before the Portuguese went, in fact, the first to go there, India was a very wealthy country, and probably the wealthiest in the world at that time. But it's now a country of enormous poverty because of the way in which the whole global history has unfolded. So many problems. It's not possible to avoid them. You can't not see them. But what we do, we don't know what to do. So we sort of blank ourselves off. We numb ourselves. Because what else can you do? We just start not seeing. I see it in India itself, where you see middle-class Indians who are living a comfortable life that actually probably most of us would envy in many cases, and they're hugger-mugger with the most appalling poverty. So you sort of wonder, how can they, you know, do it side by side? Everybody as a tourist knows this dilemma. What they do is they just don't see it. Or they have a story that explains that poverty, which traditionally has been the story of karma, of caste. People are like that because of their karma, they're owed it. So it's not my problem. You know, people will not express that very directly. Sophisticated people will not express that very directly. But the attitude is there in many, many people that I know. Just we have similar attitudes here, of course. But we're faced with that suffering, we have to find some strategy for dealing with it. And our strategy usually is the strategy of ignoring. So we have to find a way of feeling that we're making some contribution to it. Otherwise, well, it impacts upon us. We will be limited. You can't do the metta bhavana if you're closing yourself to the suffering in the world. It will be limited. Your own development will be affected by that, to put it in selfish terms. In other regarding terms, well, you'll just be frustrated that you're not really making some contribution. So I think it's extremely important that as a spiritual practitioner, you feel you are making some contribution to changing the suffering and oppression that there is in the world, the injustice that there is in the world, that you're doing something to turn the tide. You can't solve it all yourself. You can't end poverty yourself. But you can make some contribution. And unless you're doing that, I think it has a huge sort of closing effect upon your own heart and on your own spiritual life and practice. We're up against a system that doesn't deliver happiness, even to those in the wealthy world. You know, I think it's more and more evident, even from controlled inquiry and so forth, that beyond a certain point, wealth does not create happiness. In fact, it creates often the reverse, because there's insecurity and all the problems that go with wealth. We're up against a system that doesn't deliver happiness. We exist in a world that believes that consumption is progress. It's amazing, isn't it? We're in this terrible economic crisis, and the solution that the world's leaders have come to is that we should all buy more. It is. That's absolutely literally what they decided, that we should all buy more, and they're making it easy for us to buy more. So it's a system that's sort of built on consumption, and the consumption always has to be growing. Otherwise it all breaks down. It's crazy. It just doesn't make sense when you sort of think about it. But we're all part of it. We're all involved with it. This crazy system of consumption where there's a sort of a goal in front of you of the perfect, you know, mobile phone or computer or whatever it is. Or, you know, even better distribution of food and so on. There's this illusion that by consuming we will get happiness. It's just, you know, I'm not exaggerating. That is what it really amounts to. This is the system which we live in the midst of. This is the world that we live in. And it's that our consumption affects people all over the world. For instance, in India, since the economy liberalised in the early 1990s, malnutrition has grown. Liberalisation is good for us because it means we can sell our goods. But in India, it means the rich get richer and the poor get poorer. So the whole of our way of life affects people all over the world. Of course, some people get richer in India. There's no doubt about it. And in fact, a lot of the people I'm in contact with, their lives have improved quite a bit because of the growth of the Indian economy. But I'm in contact with thousands, hundreds of thousands of others whose lives are getting worse because of it. I'm also in contact with people whose lives are sort of better, but is it better to be spending 12 hours a day, 6.5 days a week in a call centre? Is that improvement? That's what some of my friends are doing. So our this consumer world that we live in, that we're all part of, that we're all in a sense supporting because we buy, and because many of us, you know, it's very difficult not to get the latest mobile phone. I haven't got mine with me. I've got one that's 12 years old and I refuse to get a new one, except it won't work anymore. But we're sort of provoked into getting better and better, and there's a whole industry that's telling us we must. There's a government that's deliberately trying to stimulate our consumption. It's crazy. We've got a government that wants us to be greedy because that's good for the economy and that makes everything work. So we're in the middle of this crazy system that doesn't actually deliver greater happiness. Of course it improves some lives, perhaps a lot of lives in some ways, but beyond a certain point it doesn't, and it leads to huge problems in other parts of the world. What's happening in the Arab world? They see what we've got and they want it, but they can't get it, so they want to blow things up to get it, those who do that. You see what I mean? And you see it in India too, that people want the West. They can see it on their televisions. They think that's nirvana. So we live in the middle of this crazy system, and we're most of us affected by it, bought into it, and aiding it in one way or another. All of us, me too. So we need to live our lives in a different way. We need to live our lives as a solution to those problems. For our own sake, because otherwise our spiritual practice is really difficult and is naturally sort of confined, and for the sake of others around us, for the sake of our human solidarity. We need to live our lives in a new way so that we're part of the solution. It's not just a question of recycling your glass. That's not going to solve the problems of the world. There needs to be a completely new way of life, a new relationship to the people around us, a new way of interacting with the world. It's not clear what that is, but that's what we're here for. That's what we're trying to do through a centre like this. We're trying to create a new way of life. We're stumbling towards a new way of life in which we work together in such a way that we're contributing to the solution rather than contributing to the problem. Of course, where the immediate question of the problems that people experience in what we loosely call the third world are concerned, we do have a collective response in our order. We have several collective responses, but we have a major response, which is through our work in India. Because in India, there's the opportunity for the Dhamma to have a major effect upon a whole society. I mentioned the other day on Sunday that there's a political party that may even be forming a government in the next, when these elections are declared. It probably won't, but it could do, and one day it will, if the leader survives, Mayawati. If she survives, she said when she's prime minister, she will convert to Buddhism. When she converts, hundreds of thousands of people will convert, there's no doubt. Whether she does or not, politicians' promises are easy. But there's no doubt that she's already, her espousal of Buddhist images at the very least, and espousal of Buddhist rhetoric at the very least, is having a huge effect. If a significant number of people, especially from the poorer castes and communities, the most oppressed castes and communities, come into the Dhamma, come into Buddhism, it'll have a massive effect on one of the two countries that's going to lead the world in the next century or so. China and India are going to be the dominant powers in the world. And if India is strongly influenced by the Dhamma, it'll have effect upon the whole world. So it's the one situation where we've got a big lever, if you see what I mean. There's nowhere else in the world. I mean, we can do good things everywhere in the world, and it's good that we're doing something in South Africa and so on. But there's the one country where actually we've got a lever, where people want the Dhamma. And so we our work in India is our collective contribution to these huge problems that the world suffers from. Not excluding working anywhere else, I assure you, and not excluding working here on the huge problems that are here. So Sangharakshita asks his disciples, in effect you could say, to renounce consumerism, to get off the treadmill, to buy out, to sell out, maybe that would be a better expression, live a simple life. If possible, he says, live a communal life, both because that will support your spiritual efforts and because it's a better use of resources. A community uses resources better. So it's good for you, it's good for the world. And when you're together, you can more effectively do something to change things. If you're not part of a literal living community, well, be part of an active social community, if you like, such as we have here at the LBC, where we're in such vivid and intense interaction with each other that your own life is supported and you have your social needs met. You don't need to get so much excitation and strong sensation to compensate for your alienation. He says, if possible, find work in team-based right livelihood. Right livelihood is essential. You must be engaged in that, otherwise it's unethical, and that will affect you. But he says, if possible, work together. Buddhists work together, and you will then get both a contribution to your own life, but you'll also be exemplifying something that would be a benefit to the whole world. That's what we try to do through, our teams. We have a team running the centre. We have the cherry, the wild cherry. We have Friends Organic. Unfortunately, all of these are up against it economically at the moment. But they're very, very precious institutions because they are the sort of leading edge of us trying to create an alternative world, a world that's an alternative to consumerism. This is what we try to do through a centre like this. I think it's the most important aspect of our work. It's not enough just for people to come along, learn a practice that's good for them. It's wonderful if that happens. I'm very, very happy if people learn to meditate and go away happier and a bit more relaxed and so on. But what we really want is to provide an alternative to the consumer world in which we're all embedded, which is a real contribution, a real solution, rather than a continuation of the new, rather than just making Buddhism a fashion accessory. You know, I'm being a bit brutal, but you know what I mean. So if we need to cherish these most intense situations. They're not easy, and they're not easy to sustain. We need to cherish them, and we need those of us who don't want to live like that or can't live like that or work like that, well, we need to try to approximate to them in our own work. We need to be counteracting the consumer world around us. This is what Sangharakshita has strongly urged his disciples to do. There's a strong tendency, because of the success of this consumer society, despite its present crisis, it's an extraordinarily successful model. It's worked, you know, throughout my life. It's just been a steady ladder of improvement. I think people are now something like 5 times wealthier than they were when I was born 60 years ago at the end of the Second World War. An incredible increase in wealth. And it's just carried on. You've had our ups and downs. There have been crunches and crises and so on. But the overall direction has been pretty steadily a huge increase in wealth. So you can't help thinking this could go on forever. It can't. Nothing goes on forever. And the system has contradictions within it that mean it cannot. So we need to do something about it. It does not deliver happiness here. It does not deliver happiness in India. So this is a very, very important aspect of Sangharakshita's teaching that I think needs invigorating and re-expressing. What I've said today is a sort of first step at finding a way of re-expressing it. But so this is part of what he teaches very, very strongly. It's not a dispensable part of it. He's recently reaffirmed this aspect of his teaching. Even if you can't engage with it very deeply yourself, please appreciate it and value it and contribute to it in whatever way you can. And try to get something of that in your own life, a different life, a life that's apart from the consumer treadmill. So in the FWBO we offer a deepening experience of discipleship and we offer a presentation of the Dharma that will enable you to be an active Dharma practitioner, will enable you to commit yourself more and more deeply to Dharma practice. As a friend, you can come, you can take it, you can leave it. As a Mitra, well, yes, you make a certain level of commitment to that presentation of the Dharma and even to that spiritual teacher and the spiritual community through which he's expressed his teaching. But we don't insist on it, and it's up to you how far you take it. As an order member, you definitely commit yourself as a disciple, whether direct or indirect, and you take on that presentation of the Dharma. You're not confined to it, but you try to make that the basis of your practice, and whatever you do that develops from it, you integrate carefully within it in consultation with your own teachers and friends. So we offer you entry to a system of spiritual training as a disciple. And this book sets out what that system of spiritual training is. And as such, I recommend it to you. But I recommend especially that once you've dipped into it, you go to the source itself. Go to the horse's mouth rather than the... I can't continue the metaphor. But that's what I've tried to do. I've tried to introduce you to Sangharakshita's presentation of the Dharma so that you can engage yourself with it if you want to. And please don't forget that this is intended to change the world, not just to change you. And by goodness, the world needs changing. Thank you very much.